KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Canada's next Prime Minister channels Taylor Swift, says the country will, quote, never, ever be part of the United States. We'll look at what his first moves might be in the trade war initiated by the U.S. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, drug deaths are falling in all 50 states. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. This news leads to a question that is hopeful but still hard. How to help people who live with fentanyl addiction. Also, protesters return to Selma 60 years later and say they made progress and say why they think it's fading. A writer's pandemic dog inspired poetry. It's Monday, March 10th. This day in 1864, President Abraham Lincoln named a new head of the army, Ulysses S. Grant, who led the way to victory. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Wall Street markets are tumbling again today as they did last week. Investors are apparently reacting to weekend comments from President Trump. He did not explicitly rule out the chance of a recession, but warned there might be a period of transition. Markets are also reacting to the on-again, off-again tariffs Trump has slapped on other nations. Trump remains very enthusiastic about them.
Well, I think the tariffs are going to be the greatest thing we've ever done as a country. It's going to make our country rich again.
And Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick says U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum will take effect on Wednesday. Trump vows other tariffs will resume on April 2nd. The tariffs are infuriating other nations. Mark Carney, the new leader of Canada's Liberal Party, will be sworn in soon as the next Canadian prime minister. He has vowed to fight the tariffs. Meanwhile, retaliatory Chinese tariffs on U.S. farm products go into effect today. NPR's John Ruwitch reports these will escalate a simmering trade war.
China is imposing tariffs of 10 to 15% on products including U.S. chicken, wheat, corn, soybeans, and pork. These are some of the biggest U.S. farm exports to China. The tariffs were announced in retaliation for the Trump administration's decision to impose a fresh 10% tariff on Chinese imports to the United States last week. That came atop a 10% tariff on Chinese goods in early February. The White House says the tariffs are designed to help stop the flow of the deadly synthetic opioid fentanyl into the United States. China is a major source of the precursor chemicals to make the drug. Beijing says the U.S. tariffs violate World Trade Organization rules, and it's vowed to firmly counter further U.S. pressure. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Beijing.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is announcing huge cutbacks at the U.S. Agency for International Development. Writing online, he says that after a six-week review, 83% of the programs at USAID will be canceled. Federal immigration officers arrested a former Columbia University graduate student over the weekend. His detention is expected to be among the first to fulfill an executive order from President Trump. NPR's Jimenez Bustillo reports the order seeks to punish people deemed to be supporting groups that the U.S. has designated as terrorists.
Mahmoud Khalil was arrested in his university-owned apartment over the weekend and transferred to a detention center in Louisiana. The administration has argued Khalil, who played a prominent role in protests against the Israel-Hamas war, forfeited his right to remain in the country by supporting the terrorist group Hamas. Khalil is a green card holder, which offers him permanent residency in the U.S. as long as he abides by U.S. laws. His lawyers are likely to fight the move to revoke his green card in immigration court. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 325 points. The Nasdaq is down 650 points. It's NPR. The British Coast Guard says it's responding to a major ship collision and fire off the east coast of England. A cargo ship and an oil tanker have hit each other and both are burning. Officials at a British port say that at least 32 people have been brought ashore, but their conditions are not immediately clear. British Coast Guard officials say they have dispatched ships with the ability to fight fires to the scene. In the U.S., March is known for wild swings in weather. However, it hasn't yet reached the middle of the month, and the weather forecast is unusually mild for many parts of the country. NPR's Amy Held reports on an upcoming widespread warming trend.
Most states can expect to experience at least 70 degrees this week, as waves of low pressure from Canada are expected to push temperatures up to 30 degrees above normal in the Dakotas and Minnesota, then move eastward. Warmth that could be sustained above normal temperatures also forecast in much of the eastern U.S. next week, in sharp contrast to what the National Weather Service says was likely the coldest winter the U.S. has seen in at least a decade, thanks to unusual Arctic air blasts that made the U.S. an outlier. Globally, January went down as the hottest the Earth has ever seen. Heat records keep breaking as humans keep burning fossil fuels, the primary cause of climate change. Amy Held, NPR News.
A pair of nesting bald eagles in California has hatched a third eaglet. Followers are tracking the live eagle cam installed by the nonprofit group Friends of Big Bear Valley. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
On a Monday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Coming up, Canada's Liberal Party has elected a new leader to take over for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. We'll hear about who Mark Carney is and what his approach may be with President Trump. First, though, over the weekend, House Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled a plan to keep the federal government running through September.
They're doing what lawmakers have done again and again and again and again in recent years. Instead of passing the annual 12 spending bills in what's called regular order with a lot of choices and compromises, Republicans want to largely keep the government running on autopilot under last year's budget numbers for a while they discuss all this. Congress needs to approve something by Friday or face another government shutdown.
NPR political correspondent Susan Davis is here now. So Republicans control Congress and the White House. So, Sue, why couldn't they come up with a plan to pass the annual spending bills instead of this stopgap?
You know, for Republicans, that would have been like choosing the path of most resistance. Passing all 12 of those bills usually requires an incredible amount of party unity and would also have likely required bipartisan negotiations with Democrats. Republicans aren't all that interested in that path right now. They really don't want to burn all of this political capital on spending bills because the party is way more focused on passing a separate budget bill to extend President Trump's tax cuts. That is the priority focus for the Republican Party over the next several months because they expire at the end of the year. But even the stopgap path is going to test party unity. Speaker Johnson has never been able to pass these spending bills or stopgaps without some Democratic support, and it's unclear if he's going to be able to do it this week either.
Yeah, Democrats were purposefully cut from this process. Are they going to support it?
Well, the top House Democratic leaders over the weekend came out and said they're going to oppose it. This is unlike past deals where Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has helped deliver the votes to avoid these shutdowns. If House Democrats remain unified against it, the speaker is essentially going to need unanimous support from within his own party, and that's going to be tough.
That sounds like a place where the president could step in, though.
Yeah, I mean, President Trump is certainly trying to keep pressure on the Republican rank and file. In a social media post over the weekend, he was asking for, quote, no dissent on this. And there's a sign he might get it. One of those traditional hardline conservatives who likes to vote against these types of spending bills. That's Texas Congressman Chip Roy. He's also a member of the Freedom Caucus. He's indicated that he will support it, which is a good sign for the speaker.
So considering all this, Sue, I mean, how likely is a shutdown on Friday?
You know, I think it's going to be pretty clear early in the week. The House is expected to vote on Tuesday, and if they can't pass a bill, the shutdown becomes exponentially more likely by Friday. If they can pass that hurdle, a handful of Democrats are still going to be necessary to get it through the Senate. At least one of those Democrats, Pennsylvania's John Fetterman, has indicated he'll be on board. It's unclear if others will be. And Trump is already trying to put the blame on Democrats if there is a shutdown. But I think that's going to be a bit of a hard sell when it's his party that controls all the levers here and have also made clear that Democrats didn't have a seat at the table.
For Democrats, though, what might they want in this deal?
I mean, Democrats are trying to get language into any deal that is going to make it harder for the Trump administration to cut off funding for things that Congress has already appropriated money for, obviously in response to things like cutting off funding for USAID. They wanted to tie the hands of this ongoing DOGE effort, and that was obviously going to be a non-starter for this White House. I also think it tells you, that as long as Republicans are in control of Congress, they're not going to be putting up much of a fight over the Trump administration's push to play a bigger role here in deciding what money gets spent and what gets cut, which, as Steve noted at the top, this is a power that traditionally is supposed to be decided by Congress, and they're willing to cede much of that power in this moment more to the White House and President Trump.
All right, that's NPR political correspondent Susan Davis. Susan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Let's learn something now about Canada's next leader, Mark Carney. Has not held an elected office, but he knows something about government and finance. He once led Canada's central bank and managed it well enough that he was hired to run the central bank of a different country, the Bank of England. Now Canada's Liberal Party has elected him as its head, which means he soon becomes prime minister. Colin Robertson is a former Canadian diplomat, a fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, which is a nonpartisan think tank, and he's on the line. Good morning, sir.
Good to be with you, Steve.
What does Mark Carney bring to the table as a leader?
Well, he's smart, he's confident, he has a real sense of public service. I met him in the 90s when he'd first come to Ottawa to work at our finance department. He'd been at Goldman Sachs, and one of my friends in Toronto said, get to know this guy, he's a comer. And I was impressed by him. He's written a big book, which is a bit of a slog, it's like a PhD thesis, but he cares about climate, the economy. Safe hands. He wouldn't be accused of being particularly charismatic, but he wants to put the emphasis on growth, which is what Canada needs today, if we're going to pay for all the things that you need, like public services and defense.
You mentioned Goldman Sachs, the American financial firm. Sounds like he knows the United States pretty well.
Yes, I think he does. He went to Harvard, then he went to Oxford. In his career as a central banker, both for Canada and Britain, he would get to know all the Americans. So yes, he'll have a big network. I think he met Trump when Trump was president the first time at a G20 meeting.
Now, he has a problem with President Trump immediately because the president has repeatedly referred to Canada as the 51st state, has imposed tariffs, also taken off some tariffs or delayed some tariffs. We're in the middle of an extremely confusing trade war. Do you feel you understand what his approach will be?
Well, I think all Canadians have a problem with Mr. Trump, and he just reflects where Canadians are coming from. Will he have a challenge to Mr. Trump? Probably, but he'll listen to Mr. Trump and make the case for Canada and why this makes no sense. And I hope Mr. Trump pays attention because it doesn't make any sense. We have this, we make things together. We have this mutually beneficial relationship that goes back decades, going back to before the Second World War with Franklin Roosevelt, and our then Prime Minister Mackenzie King put in place this framework for access to the United States. In return, we'd watch your back on the North.
Well, I'm thinking that through. There are so many ways that Canadians are connected with Americans through history. Canadian troops as well as American troops went ashore on D-Day. Canadians helped to rescue Americans from Tehran during the Iranian Revolution. I could go on and on.
9/11, exactly. There's all sorts of things.
And Canadians have structured their economy to be closely integrated with the United States. Are Canadians now saying this was a mistake? We need to figure things out a different way.
We're certainly looking at all the options, yes. I think there's a sense that if you can't rely on what has been your friend, your neighbor, and principal partner, you've got to look to other means, so trade diversification. But we're also dealing with what we call the unfinished business of confederation. Since 1867, we've had a lot of trade barriers between our 13 provinces and territories, and now that's being taken on in a big way because that'll help the economy. But the preference would be to maintain that secure access to the United States. That's the first option. So we've been mounting a major campaign over the last year, even before the election, to just remind Americans how much we depend on each other. 37 American states, our biggest export markets, Canada. So this really does make no sense what Mr. Trump is doing.
Are you trapped? And by this, I mean you've structured things in a way that you don't have any choice but to deal with the U.S. For example, the oil pipelines run from Canada down to the United States. Do you not have any choice?
Well, that to a large degree, geography is destiny, and you can't change our geography. That's correct. Again, why this doesn't make a lot of sense. But we are looking now to other options. Our former Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, who's 91, yesterday at the convention said, look, we should build a pipeline to the East Coast so we can start providing energy to Europe that wants it. So I think all options are on the table now.
Just got
and
a few seconds.
Broad unity between our premiers who are of other parties and the Prime Minister, and that's really important as well. Like the United States, we're a federation.
Just got a few seconds, Mr. Robertson, but I want to note you are not in Canada right now. You're in Sarasota, Florida. What are you hearing from Americans?
Well, I'm struck by my neighbors who are coming up to me because I know I'm Canadian and almost apologetic, saying this isn't what they voted for. Most of them voted for Trump. I am living in a district that voted heavily for Trump, and they think this is a bad idea, and they're, as I say, they're apologetic, and it is a bad idea. And I say, well, phone your congressman. Tell them this is a bad idea. It's not working for you. Remember, Canadians used to spend 50 million nights a year in Florida, so that's also a hit if we don't come down to Florida.
Colin Robertson is vice president at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Since Donald Trump took office, Mexico has been a constant target of threats of potential military action and of new tariffs. Mexico's president has called for cooler heads to prevail. Yesterday, she called for a rally in the center of Mexico City, and some 350,000 people showed up. Here's NPR's Eider Peralta.
On Sunday, the streets of Mexico City are completely packed. On T-shirts and placards, demonstrators say they are here to defend their country. Yesenia Guillen, who is 30, came with a group of friends to tell President Claudia Sheinbaum that she is not alone. President Trump, she said, should take note.
Que si quiere ver un México dividido está equivocado.
If he wants to see a divided Mexico, she said, he's mistaken because we're a strong, dignified country. Sheinbaum called Mexicans to the streets right after President Trump slapped all Mexican exports with a 25% tariff. She said she would unveil retaliatory measures at this rally, but 2 days later, Trump suspended the tariffs, and Sheinbaum told Mexicans to come out anyway.
Los mexicanos somos pacifistas. Somos respetuosos.
Maria de la Luz Rivera Mendoza, a 58-year-old lawyer, says Mexicans are pacifists. We're respectful, but we can also be angry. She says she came here to tell her president that if she needs her, she's ready for battle.
A todo por la defensa de mi patria y a todo porque a mi país se le respeta.
I'll do anything, she said, to defend my country. President Sheinbaum has called on Mexicans to keep a cool head, to avoid antagonism. So here, there are no anti-American slogans, no effigies of Trump. And as President Sheinbaum takes the stage, she remains ever the diplomat. Yes, we remember, she says, the U.S. has invaded our country twice, but we choose to focus on the positive.
Afortunadamente, ha prevalecido el diálogo.
Fortunately, she says, dialogue and respect between our nations has prevailed. And on this Sunday, at least, celebration triumphs over belligerence. Eider Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Bill Burr talks about his anger issues, which are hilarious on stage, but not so much in real life, and how therapy, mushrooms, and becoming a father have helped. The interview was a wild ride, which I really enjoyed. He has a new Hulu comedy special and is a star of the new Broadway revival of Glengarry Glen Ross. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Subaru, the 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Reginald Dwayne Betts has authored 4 collections of poetry and a memoir. He's also a lawyer and an educator, so his is a life in words. But his route to that life was a circuitous one. He spent more than 8 years in prison for an armed carjacking committed when he was 16. He started writing in prison, including some of the poetry in this latest collection. It's called Doggerel, and he's with us now to tell us more about it. Dwayne, good to talk with you again. Thanks so much for talking to us.
It's my complete and absolute honor.
So remind us again of what the classic definition of doggerel is. And then, of course, you know I'm going to ask you, what's yours?
Yeah, so doggerel classically just means mediocre poetry. And I chose the name of doggerel because doggerel isn't really just mediocre poetry. Poetry is meant to serve a purpose. And sometimes we don't let poetry serve its purpose because we think that it has to be on some certain kind of level. And we define our audience first. I wanted to write poems that said this is for everybody. So if you're looking for some laughter, it's something here for you. If you're looking for love, it's something here for you. But I also wanted to cleverly sneak the word dog into the title because so many of these poems came out of my experience getting a dog during the pandemic and walking a dog and really seeing the world as a man who just, you know, had a new friend that was showing me things and revealing things to me that I just didn't pay attention to, including joy.
Just right up front, you say, it's nah, just a black man writing poems about his dog and all the dogs he encounters on the street and how having an extra 4 feet changed his world. And then he falls in love.
Yo, it's funny, man. It's not even just that I have a dog now. I have a dog now. And honestly, I think about dogs and I think about the relationship that they've allowed me to build with people. I mean, I've had the wildest things happen. I've had like white guys pull over on the side of the road. It's like, hey, I got 2 Jack Russell Terriers. You know,
you have a Jack Russell Terrier?
Yeah.
That is like TV dog, you know, that dog
literally is. And it's a dog that is obsessed with truly believing that it's smarter than you, probably is smarter than you.
Well, how did he come into your life?
It was the pandemic and we were starving for life. And the idea to get a dog came from my ex. And I think she was right. You know, we needed an animal to give us a different sense of ourselves. And it did for the 4 of us. And me in particular, though, I think what it did was make me notice the relationships and interactions that I had with other people because of Taylor. I get up at, you know, early in the morning, 3, 4, 5, and I'm taking a walk and I'm riding my bicycle. I begin to see that this was the dog owner's hour. And the people around me, because I began to notice them more for their dogs, they would like notice me. And I would read them poems, people in my community, people in my neighborhood, people in the elevator. If you had a dog, it was an invitation to have a conversation.
Wait, you would read them poems from doggerel that were about dogs?
Yeah.
Or really, yeah. That's kind of...
Let me tell you what I did to somebody. It was so aggressively rude. I had just met the person and we did not know each other. And then they picked up the phone and they were on a phone call. A friend of theirs dog had died. I said, oh, put me on speaker. He looked at me like, why do you think I'm going to do that? I don't even know you. I just met you, Dwayne, 5 minutes ago. I said, I know. Put me on speaker. Why? I'm going to read y'all a poem. What are you talking about, sir? He puts me on speaker. I read him Grief. They both gasp when I get to the end. And they're like, thank you for that. But the thing is, I would have never done that if it was 2 people talking about the loss of a loved one.
The one that you read, would you read the one, is it Grief?
Yeah, that was Grief. Grief. The story of Easy, a small dog who I imagine is named after Mosley's detective, crawls into the space left by Zinnia, burrowing into corners against door frames beneath a house in search of a phantom smell. State Fair, Sahara, Thumbelina, Dreamland, Envy, Orange Star, Creeping Zinnias that bloom until first frost. My God, the ways we grieve again and again, because the only rule of life is to forget means to abandon. When I forget to feed Tay, she never barks but waits wherever I am, as if she trusts my memory more than I do. I imagine this is grief's lesson. It is the engine of making what happened before matter. And it's true that I've only ever remembered a few joys as much as I've recounted all my reasons to grieve. But nothing grows without weeping, not even joy.
Beautiful. I love it. Thank you so much. I got to ask you about a piece that you recently published in the New York Times, an opinion piece about having the police called on you at a bike shop that you had patronized for years. And you just talked about just the, I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, the rage, the emotion that welled up on you, and that even the police officer could see that you were getting emotional. Is that true?
Well, my initial impulse was I was incredulous. I could not believe that I wasn't being allowed to complete a single sentence that would have alleviated the chaos. I got a Harvard identification on me. I got a Yale identification on me, and I got a bar card on me. But I know that I could say something.
A bar card signals that you're a member of the bar, the state bar, meaning that you're a lawyer.
Right. And I knew that none of that was gonna solve the day, but I also knew that the burden was on me to prove that I deserved to be treated with some dignity.
What I took from the piece is that you were so deeply hurt and that you went back to the store, and just to tie a bow on it, you actually did go back and buy a bike at the store.
Right. I felt like that's what I needed to do because I was going to suffer if I didn't. I don't know what happened to him this morning. I am not just going to assert a motivation for him because I'm so tired of people asserting motivations for me. When I bought the bike, it was his daughter. I didn't know it was his daughter. She was the most lovely human being I had met. And he had already coded in a discount for me because I told him I was going to come back. And so I don't need to name what motivated what happened on the day I almost got arrested. I would like to name what motivated what happened every subsequent day after. And I like to believe one of the things that motivated his behavior was his recognition. Like, he kind of failed me as a human being. And I went back to be like, I am not going to double down on this notion that I need to treat you in a certain way because that's how you treated me.
That's Reginald Dwayne Betts. His latest collection of poems is called Doggerel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
First, scientists figured out how to restore movement to people who are paralyzed. Then, they realized picking up a cup is easier if you can feel it.
They hooked me up to the machine, and like, it was the first time I felt my index finger, and I'm like, whoa.
I'm Elsa Chang, how scientists are engineering a sense of touch on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Despite strained relations between the U.S. and Ukraine, envoy Steve Witkoff tells Fox News that the Trump administration is still assisting Ukraine in its defense against Russia.
We never shut off intelligence for anything defensive that the Ukrainians need. So that's never been shut off.
Witkoff says negotiators from both sides are expected to meet this week in Saudi Arabia to talk about a framework for peace that ends the Russia-Ukraine war. Both sides are also expected to discuss U.S. access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals, the same deal that was supposed to happen over a week ago before the blow-up involving Presidents Trump and Zelensky at the White House. Immigration agents have arrested an activist who helped lead pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. NPR's Adrian Florido has more on Mahmoud Khalil.
Khalil was one of the Palestinian students who last year negotiated on behalf of the campus protesters who were pressing Columbia to divest from Israel over the Gaza war. He was outspoken, very involved. He recently graduated. I spoke with his lawyer, and she told me that on Saturday night, Khalil and his wife were arriving at their university apartment and that ICE agents were in the lobby. They told Khalil his student visa had been canceled. But Khalil is not on a visa. He is a legal permanent resident.
NPR's Adrian Florido reporting. This is NPR News. Japan marked the World War II firebombing of Tokyo on this day 80 years ago. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that the Tokyo bombing is estimated to have killed more people than the better-known atomic bombings of Japan that followed.
Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba sent a message to a memorial service urging people to pass the horrific war's lessons on to future generations. On March 9th and 10th, 1945, U.S. Air Force B-29 bombers dropped some 1,600 tons of firebombs on Tokyo, destroying more than half of the city. Around 100,000 people were killed, more than a million were left homeless. While the government has compensated World War II veterans, atomic bombing survivors, and their families, Tokyo air raid survivors have received nothing. Lawmakers in Japan are trying to agree on a bill that would compensate some victims. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
A more than 12,000-foot volcano is erupting near the Guatemalan capital. Guatemala's disaster agency says the flow of volcanic material is weak to moderate, but that's expected to pick up. There have been no immediate reports of injuries. Hundreds of people have been evacuated, though, while tens of thousands more may be at risk from the volcano fire, one of the most active in Central America. U.S. stocks are trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 381 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. The deadliest phase of the fentanyl crisis appears to be over, in the United States anyway. New research shows fatal overdoses from fentanyl and other street drugs are dropping from their peak in all 50 states. Here's NPR's Brian Mann.
When Nebarim Desgupta's team at the University of North Carolina finished their new analysis of drug death data, they found a positive trend that seemed inconceivable a year ago.
We are on track to return to levels of overdose before fentanyl emerged.
Drug deaths tracked nationwide by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have already plunged 24% from peak levels. Every state has now seen improvement, with many states improving by 30, 40, even 50%. Dasgupta says the number of lives being saved left him stunned.
It has been a complete shock, the numbers declining in the way that they have been. I thought, it's even hard to talk about because it's, after all this time looking at overdose deaths, this is what we have been hoping for.
Data is one thing. Reality on the street can feel very different. This is Kensington, long known as one of the country's most drug-plagued neighborhoods in Philadelphia. On a warm afternoon, Elena and Vadim lean against a fence, smoking a mix of fentanyl and xylazine. NPR agreed not to use last names because their drug use is illegal. I ask how this national shift feels here, and Elena says she's noticed the change.
Yeah, I can tell, you know, the numbers drop. A lot more people also started smoking instead of shooting. I think that made a difference. And also,
smoking fentanyl and xylazine is still incredibly risky, but it's considered safer than using needles. Vadim says many people who use fentanyl are also taking smaller doses.
When fentanyl just came out, they're used to shooting heroin in the same amounts. So that's why they were dying, because you need a lot less.
They say there are more public health services here on the street, and people routinely carry naloxone or Narcan to reverse fentanyl overdoses. All this has contributed to nearly 2,000 fewer deaths a year in Pennsylvania alone compared with the peak. Dr. Nora Volkoff, who heads the U.S. government's National Institute on Drug Abuse, says she believes the U.S. as a whole has reached a turning point.
It's very, very exciting to see it, that it's dramatically decreasing.
While overall drug deaths are down 24%, Volkoff says deaths linked specifically to fentanyl are dropping even faster, down more than 30%. If that trend holds, the U.S. could soon return to levels not seen since 2016, when fentanyl hit.
It would be exciting if one returns to those values, because fentanyl just turned us all upside down.
Volkoff and Dasgupta also agree this shift appears to be long-term and sustainable. Dasgupta's deep dive into CDC records found nearly half the states actually saw recoveries beginning much earlier than once understood, with fatal overdoses peaking back in 2021 and 2022, then beginning a steady decline.
This is a clear public health improvement, no matter how you measure it. It's been sustained in some states for years.
The result nationally is roughly 25,000 fewer drug deaths every year. But Dasgupta and other addiction experts say this isn't a time to declare victory. They describe these improvements more as a crucial first step, meaning less death, but also a lot more people surviving with severe addiction and chronic illness needing help. Dr. Ben Cocciaro treats addiction patients here in Kensington.
It does seem to be less lethal. Not less dangerous, right? Because we're seeing plenty of other problems that come from it. Xylazine has really bad skin wounds. Metatomidine has just a terrible withdrawal syndrome.
Back on the street, I ask Elena about this. She tells me she doesn't feel as likely to die from fentanyl and xylazine, which is also known as Trank, but her addiction is still severe and she's often dangerously ill.
So I did end up with some Trank sores, some wounds like MRSA. And I was hospitalized for that. It's pretty bad, actually.
MRSA is a drug-resistant bacterial infection hitting a lot of people who use street drugs. Vadim holds up his gnarled hands and says he also has skin wounds caused by xylazine.
My hands swell up and then it doesn't heal up.
But the fact Vadim and Elena are still here, able to talk to me, that's progress. Addiction research shows even people using toxic street drugs like fentanyl and xylazine have a strong shot at long-term recovery. But of course, that's only possible if they're alive.
I have hope, though. I have to, you know.
Recovery is possible. It's how much we wanted. We both had clean time, so we know it's possible.
Later on All Things Considered, we'll look at how communities like Kensington are struggling to find resources to help the growing number of people who survive addiction move toward healing and recovery. Brian Mann, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Protesters from the original Bloody Sunday march in Selma, Alabama say there is still work to be done. Thousands gathered in Selma over the weekend to mark 60 years since the historic Civil Rights March, where the images of police attacking peaceful demonstrators helped rally support for the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Here's NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Sunday's march was led by the foot soldiers who survived the violence on Edmund Pettus Bridge 60 years ago.
Everybody, drop the wheelchairs. Nobody move. Hold your position.
From the front row, foot soldier Eugene Daniels recalls being beat as he and others tried to march from Selma to Montgomery. He was a 17-year-old high school student at the time.
It didn't matter what age of, you know, you were, you know, old, young, everybody. It was a, when they call it Bloody Sunday, you can put an emphasis on that when they say Bloody Sunday, yeah?
Daniels lives in Ohio now. He says he wanted to come back to Selma to protest what he sees as a rollback of the progress he fought for in 1965.
Let's regroup and restart again. The fight is not over.
It was a sentiment echoed by those who joined him for this bridge crossing. Diamond White, who's 32, is from Edwards, Mississippi. She says she feels a sense of urgency watching the dismantling of federal diversity efforts.
I feel like the time is, we're back 60 years ago, where we at now in America. And so coming out here, I felt like it was important. A lot of people felt like it was important that you could see the crowd. But it's just like we have to think about history. History can predict our futures.
History students from John Brown University in Arkansas came to cross the bridge they've been studying about. 20-year-old Ashley Phelan finds inspiration here.
I think we need unity right now, and no matter what happens politically, we need to remember we're all on this earth together, that we're all God's children.
Some locked arms, others sang freedom songs as they made it to the other side of the bridge where marchers were brutally turned back 60 years ago. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Selma.
I'm gonna tell you that everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine.
This is NPR News.
It's been 5 years since the start of the COVID pandemic that sent the country into a lockdown, and it exacerbated a major mental health crisis. Next time, here and now.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. King Charles III is walking the world through a personal playlist. It's part of a new Apple Music radio show, Time to British Commonwealth Day. Charles says he wants to share songs that bring him joy, like Bob Marley, Grace Jones, and Kylie Minogue, all on the list. The one surprise is he did not pick Henry VIII.
I'm Henry VIII, I am. Henry VIII, I am.
It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. There's a reason you might be more tired than usual this particular morning. That's because it's the first Monday of daylight saving time. Sarah Bowden has some tips for getting you back on track.
One of my favorite neighborhood coffee spots is just a few blocks from my house.
Hey, good morning.
It always smells delicious at Espresso Amano. And this week, I'll probably be stopping here more often since I'll be extra sleepy. Espresso Amano regular Josh Lucas thinks the U.S. should just stay on the same time all year.
You get acclimated to a way of being, and then all of a sudden, the sky is a different color, and you have to still function in the normal way.
Sleep researchers and clinicians agree and say overall the time change is bad for our health. This week has a higher incidence of car accidents, strokes, and heart attacks. People eat more junk food and get more migraines. There are more drug overdoses and suicides. To understand why this transition wreaks such havoc on our brains and bodies,
it's important to understand a little bit about the basics of circadian rhythm.
Brant Hessler is a sleep and circadian researcher at the University of Pittsburgh. He says our circadian rhythm exists in almost every cell of our body.
We have this orchestra of clocks throughout our bodies, but the central clock in our brain, which we can think of as the conductor, is trying to keep in tune.
These clocks not only tell us when to sleep, but also regulate our metabolism, body temperature, several hormones. And when we force our bodies to acclimate to the time change, this symphony of internal clocks is no longer in rhythm.
The problem, particularly with spring forward, is that we are getting up relatively earlier, but we're getting up in the dark while getting more light in the evening.
Humans evolved over millennia to get up with the sun, so this is even worse than the fall time change for our sleep. And people who are sleep-deprived get irritable and impulsive. Research shows we're less generous this week, and we make worse investment decisions. One study even found that federal judges issue harsher sentences the Monday after the spring time change. Allison Harvey runs a sleep and mood research clinic at the University of California, Berkeley. She says people with depression and bipolar disorder are going to have an extra hard time this week because they already struggle to sleep.
Sleep pushes our moods around. So, of course, sleep and mental health challenges go hand in hand.
Another group to keep an eye on is teenagers who naturally wake up and fall asleep later compared to adults. Research shows 7 out of 10 high schoolers don't get enough sleep.
They will be going off to school Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday after spring forward, and it's going to be a struggle.
So what do we do about all this? The key is get to bed early. And when you get up, turn on all the lights in your house. Or if the sun's up, stand outside in the morning light. That tells your orchestra of circadian clocks it's time to wake up. Also get some exercise, don't drink afternoon coffee, and do limit alcohol.
The human sleep system is a flexible system, and we will all survive this.
So be patient with yourself and others. Most of us should feel back to normal in a week or two. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com.
This is NPR News.
Yeah.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump's hostage affairs envoy has explained his choice to hold direct talks with Hamas. Adam Bowler spoke on CNN yesterday.
The reality is what I wanted to do is jumpstart some negotiations that were in a very fragile place. And I wanted to say to Hamas, what is the end game that you want here?
NPR's Daniel Estrin has been listening to this and covering other aspects of the story. He's in Tel Aviv. Hey there, Daniel.
Good morning, Steve.
So what do you learn from Bowler's TV appearances?
Well, he offered some extraordinary details about what went on behind closed doors with Hamas. He said they didn't just talk about a hostage-prisoner exchange. They spoke about the future, with Hamas suggesting a 5 to 10 year truce with Israel, the U.S. ensuring no Hamas tunnels or military activity in Gaza, that Hamas would not be involved in governing Gaza. Steve, this is the first time we've heard specifics from inside the negotiating room about Hamas laying down its arms.
Wow, that's really interesting, and certainly more interesting than some of the strange write-ups of the CNN appearance. There were social media posts, actual news stories suggesting that Bowler called Hamas pretty nice guys. So I went and watched the video. It doesn't show him calling Hamas nice guys. He says maybe the Israelis might have feared that he would find them to be pretty nice guys. The real story there is that Israel was concerned that he reached out to Hamas for direct talks. So where does Israel stand about all this?
That's right. A main confidant of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was upset and called Adam Bowler and said, what were you doing with these direct talks? This breaks with previous U.S. policy because the U.S. classifies Hamas as a terror group. Bowler, in his interviews, tried to defend why he did meet directly with Hamas. He wanted to jumpstart the talks. You have to understand it's a very uncertain moment in Israel now. There is no real agreement on a ceasefire. And there's a lot of right-wing pressure to return to war. So you see Israel taking steps to look tough on Gaza and to appease the right-wing public.
By doing what?
Well, one step is that they've announced a cut of electricity to a desalination plant in Gaza, providing drinking water. This has limited effect because actually Israel has cut electricity to Gaza since the beginning of the war, mostly. And so now this plant will have to work on generators. And you have to understand fuel is in short supply. Israel is restricting fuel now. So that does make a difference. And then also at the Israeli parliament, we attended yesterday a hearing about Palestinian emigration from Gaza. Now, this is not happening now, but it is something that Israel wants to see happen. They've reached out to countries to try to take in Gazans. This was an attempt to breathe life into an idea that Trump himself raised several weeks ago.
It's interesting to hear all this, Daniel, because we just heard the U.S. envoy was asking Hamas, what is your end game? Where do you want this to go? That is the same question U.S. officials have asked for a couple of years now of Israelis, without really an answer coming back too clearly. So where do the talks go now?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the talks really are focused on the next weeks and what's going to happen with the hostage prisoner exchange. Israel, Hamas, and the U.S. are going to be holding talks in the coming days in Qatar. These are the most serious talks since President Trump took office. An official familiar with the matter told me that a new ceasefire deal could be coming in the coming weeks. An Egyptian official tells us there's a proposal on the table for a 2-month ceasefire with American hostages released first.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. Thanks for the insights, as always.
You're welcome.
South African playwright Athol Fugard has died. He wrote about life during and after apartheid in plays such as Blood Knot and Master Harold and the Boys. He was 92 years old. With more, here's Jeff London.
When apartheid ended and Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa, Athol Fugard thought his life as a playwright was over. He told NPR in 2015.
I sincerely believed that I was going to be South Africa's first literary redundancy. But South Africa caught me by surprise again and just said, no, you've got to keep writing, man. There are still stories to tell.
And for 6 decades and close to 36 plays, Fugard told stories about the corrosive effects of a political system which oppressed the black majority, as well as stories of the white minority. Theater critic Matt Wolff says Fugard wrote intimate stories.
I think his Bartimian canvas is the canvas of the imagination. He doesn't need huge numbers of people.
In fact, Fugard's breakthrough play, Blood Knot, featured only two actors on stage. They played brothers, one black, the other of mixed race, who can pass for white. This clip is from a New York revival in 2009.
There's more to wearing a white skin than just putting on a hat. You see white men before without hats, but they're still white men, aren't they?
Yeah. Fugard was born in 1932. His father was of English descent and an alcoholic, something the playwright struggled with himself. His mother, of Afrikaans descent, was the breadwinner, running a tea room and boarding house. He said she helped him find the empathy that guided him through the years.
Society was trying to make me conform to a set of very rigid racist ideas. And she was endowed with just a natural sense of justice and decency. And she was asking questions about the world in which the two of us found ourselves struggling. She said to me, there must be something wrong with this.
Fugard's most autobiographical play, Master Harold and the Boys, takes place in a tea room like his mother's, where the white teenage protagonist spends an afternoon with the two black men who work there. The play was banned in South Africa, was a hit around the world, and was made into a movie.
Master Harold and the Boys is a play about a breakdown of communication, about a withdrawal away from an understanding of each other into our separate, isolated little worlds.
And the collision of those worlds had serious consequences during apartheid. Fugard had his passport revoked, and many black actors he worked with ended up on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela. That notorious prison became the setting for a Tony Award-winning play, The Island, which Fugard created with actors John Connie and Winston Neshona, based on their experiences. Critic Matt Wolfe.
People who don't know much about him think that he's black. And when I say, actually, he's white, they're surprised.
Because Ethel Fugard made empathy central to his life and his work. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.